Okay, so what I'm going to do today is finish the discussion on threads, and then we will start discussion on CPU scheduling. Okay? Now keep in mind that we have already covered maybe 3 or 4 chapters in the book. Okay, so you need to please keep up with the class by reading what's in the book. Okay? Otherwise you will tend to forget things and then some of these concepts will be hazy. Okay, so do keep up. I am posting on the course schedule the corresponding sections from the book, okay, both the textbook and the suggested book on Tannenbaum, where you can find the material to elaborate on these concepts. Okay, so that's the material you need to follow. Unfortunately, there isn't internet access here, otherwise I would have shown you what to see or look on the course page. But if you look at the course schedule, the rightmost column is where I have readings, and that basically tells you what is the corresponding material in the textbook that corresponds to the lecture. Okay, that's what you really need to read for every class. Okay, so I'm going to talk about threads or remind you of what threads are. Okay, so remember what I said last time, if you take a traditional process, okay, a process basically consists of an address space. That's the part of the process that stays in memory, the code and the data segment and so on. And there is something that is executing in the process, which is referred to as the execution context. That includes the program counters and it includes the registers, okay, that support the execution. Okay? A traditional process has a single stream of execution. There's one thing that is executing in the program at any given time, one statement or one instruction. Okay? Now we can relax this notion by using the concept of threads. What threads allow you to do is have multiple concurrent execution streams or control of info or threads of control to run through the process all at the same time. Okay, so here is a figure that illustrates this. This is your traditional single threaded process. Okay, so this is basically the code and this is where you are executing the code at any given time. Okay, this is a multi-threaded process. Okay, it basically generalizes that notion by allowing multiple things to be executing within the same process at the same time. Okay, so it allows you to do concurrency. Each thread, the important thing is each thread has its own program counter, it has its own stack and it has its own register. Okay, but the data, the global variables are shared, the code segment itself is shared. Okay, the address space in other words is shared between all of the processes. Okay. This slide which I had skipped last time shows you what kinds of threading systems are supported by a variety of operating systems through the ages. Okay, so this is the very old MS-DOS which nobody uses today, but that operating system essentially allowed, it was a uniprogramming environment. Okay, only one thing could run in your system and that one thing could have only one thread running in the system. Okay. This is the old Unix environment which supported only traditional processes. It did not support the notion of threads. Early versions of Unix and Ultrix essentially had traditional processes. Each process essentially had a single thread of control. Okay, that's basically no threads. Anything above this line says operating system platforms didn't support it. These are two things that you have today. Okay. Here you have a PDA-like or lightweight operating systems which allow only one program to run at any time. But that process can actually have multiple threads. Okay, so today's phone-based operating system started with this model. Okay, you could have basically only one app to run at any time, and that app could have multiple threads. But you don't allow multi-programming. Okay, this is today's traditional operating system. Multiple processes can run. Each process can have arbitrary number of threads. Okay, so multi-programming and each process could be multi-threaded. Okay, yes, question there.
We could still support multi-threading in any of these though, right? If the program does its own threading, is that true?
Yes. So the point that was being just made is you could actually support threads in these two quadrants by doing user-level threads library. The operating system by default does not have support for thread, but you could write a library that provides thread functionality. And then you could run that library and an app on top of this operating system, and then you have user level threads, okay, which we will look at in just one moment. Okay, so this is basically sample program I showed last time. You have main process, okay, it basically creates two threads, Here one thread executes the producer code, one thread executes the consumer code. Same process, but there are two threads, each executing different parts of the program concurrently. Okay, that's important to keep in mind. So you can see here that there is one thread. It has a program counter that's basically in this loop. It's basically looping here. There's another program counter that's basically pointing here and it's looping here. And these two things are happening concurrently. Okay? And each of these threads have their own stack as is shown here. Okay, they share the text segment, and then there is the heap that is also shared by all of these threads. Okay, that's basically how you can implement a simple two-threaded application. Okay, you can have arbitrary number of threads as I shown last time. Okay? And where we stopped was basically how do you implement any threading system. Okay, I said there are two ways to do this. You can implement threads. We will soon test the Apple magnetic adapter. As I said, there are two types of threading systems. Kernel level threads, where support for threads is provided in the kernel, and user level threads, where you do it in the library. Okay? Kernel level thread is sometimes also known as a lightweight process. Okay? So here, the advantage is switching between two threads within a same process is often cheaper than switching between independent processes. Okay, so let me repeat what I just said. Switching between threads of the same process is cheaper than context switching between two independent processes. Okay, so thread-based context switches are more lightweight. They are cheaper to perform. Okay, why would that be the case? So it's the same address space. So remember what I said about a context switch. Okay, in the context switch, you have to save the state of the current process, load the state of the new process. Okay? If you are switching between threads of the same process, all you need is to save the state of the thread and load the state of a new thread. Since the memory that is being used by these two threads is shared, is the same address space, you don't need to save memory management information, which would have been additional work you would have to perform if you are switching between different processes. Okay, so you have to do less bookkeeping because it's the same process. You don't need to reload page table registers or all of that. That's the same. It hasn't changed. Okay? So threads allow you faster context switch. That's the first thing to keep in mind. Okay, so as it's basically said here, value of the registers, program counter, stack pointer must be changed, but memory management information is not changed. Okay, does not need to be changed. The other advantage is the kernel is aware of the presence of this thread, so it can actually schedule individual threads rather than scheduling a process. Okay? So if you have to pick up something to run on your CPU, you actually pick a thread belonging to a certain process. Okay, you say I will run thread 3 of process 100. Okay, so you can actually schedule individual threads directly, which allows the kernel greater flexibility in how much time it allocates to a process as a whole. Okay, process A, which may have 10 threads, and process B may have 2 threads. Okay, so kernel knows about this, so it can give more CPU time to these 10 threads in aggregate than it would do to process B. Okay, so you can do these kinds of things. Okay, now let's look at user level threads. Okay, user level thread, as I said, is a thread that the OS is not aware of. Okay, the OS only knows, OS can only see the process. Okay, in the process control block, there is no thread information at all. Okay, you only see a process level information. Okay, all that the OS can do is it can schedule that process. Okay, and then once the process gets to run, what actually happens is the thread library that implements this threading system will actually execute. Okay, the scheduler within the threads library will decide which of the many threads in your process actually gets to run. Okay, that's how you basically schedule threads within. So OS schedules the process and the threads within that process are scheduled by the threads library. Okay, similarly, all of thread management is done by the library. Okay, this includes creation, deletion, synchronization, which we have not yet looked at, okay, as well as scheduling. Okay, there's a picture here somewhere. Okay, so here's your picture. So these are processes, okay, that the kernel knows about. Okay, those things there are threads within the process. Okay, so this is the address space of this process, and those things there show you which are the threads within that process. Okay, as far as the kernel is concerned, it doesn't actually see the presence of that. It just looks at this as a single threaded program, okay, because it doesn't know any better. So by default, it assumes all processes are single threaded. There's no support for threading at the kernel level. So it will basically take a process from the ready queue and it will run to execute it, schedule time for it. And then the user level thread scheduler, which is in the threads library, will run as soon as this process runs, and then it will decide which of those threads to actually schedule for execution. Okay, so there are two levels of scheduling decision. The kernel picks a process, the threads library then picks a thread. Okay? In kernel level thread, it's a single level decision. All of those threads are actually visible here, so the CPU scheduler will actually pick a thread directly. It will say, I want to run that thread there. Okay, and then there's nothing more to do. At that point, the decision has been made. Okay, so that is, you have to keep in mind how scheduling is done when you have user level and kernel level threads. Any questions on that? Okay, so let's think now about what are some advantages and disadvantages of user level and kernel level threads. Okay, so let's think about user level threads. What is an advantage? What kinds of advantages would you get if you use user versus over a kernel level threads package? Okay, assume that you're given a choice of a user level threads package and a kernel level threads package. You can write your application using either one. Okay, both of them support threading. Okay, so as far as the application is concerned, it will look exactly the same in both cases. But when it runs, things may actually happen differently. Okay, so what are some advantages if you use user level? Yes.
User level gives you finer grain control over which process you allocate more time to, which runs first, second.
Which thread or which process?
Which
thread. Okay. Yes, you have something to say.
I was thinking user level would be more lightweight than kernel.
Yes. So there are two points have been made here. First one is user level is more lightweight. Second point is there is more control over which thread gets to run. Okay, both of those are actually advantages. Okay. Let's first think about why is user level more lightweight? Yeah.
Less system calls.
Less system calls. So thread management requires you to make library function calls. Okay, so the thread create function actually goes to the library. The library does something and creates a thread. Okay. Making a library call is going to be a lot cheaper than making a system call. Okay, system calls, as you remember, causes a trap, the process gets suspended, the OS kernel runs, it does something, and the process resumes at a later time. Lot more heavyweight than just making a function call, and the function call returns and you have a thread. Okay? So all thread management functionality is implemented as system calls in kernel level threads. They're implemented as library calls in user level threads. As a result, user level threads are more lightweight. Okay? Creating them is very, very fast. As compared to creating a kernel thread. So it's more lightweight, and then the second point was you have some control over which thread you can pick for your application. Because user level threads are implemented in a library, okay, you can pick whichever library you want. If there are 10 packages out there, okay, with 10 different libraries, you can pick the one that you like, that is most appropriate for your application. Moreover, you can write your own. If you have a very specialized need, you can write your own threads library with its own special purpose scheduler that says this is the order in which you should run these threads. Okay? In kernel level threads, you don't have any of that flexibility. Okay, that the scheduling decision is made inside the kernel. So unless you can go and modify the kernel itself, there is no way you can actually change how the scheduler works. Okay, so in commercial operating systems, you will not get access to the code, so you can't change it. Okay, open source, that may be a different issue. If you really want to hack the kernel, you can modify it. But it's much easier to do all of that in user level threads packages. Okay, and there are many more of them that you can look at and pick than over a kernel. Okay, because there's only one choice, that's the one that's implemented in the kernel. Okay. So those are advantages. Are there disadvantages you can think of? So we have only talked about benefits. What might be limitations? Yes, you have some.
Might be a lot more work to write thread screen programs if you don't have that library.
Yes, if you don't have a threads library, you will have to implement a threads package. More work. There's no question. But I mean, let's assume you are given two packages and you are trying to weigh the pros and cons. And the question is, are there cons for user level packages?
It's worse for the overall system because you're kind of taking away that scheduling ability from the kernel. So instead that you've got one process running that has 10 threads and another process running that just has one thread, that one that has 10 threads might need a lot more CPU time, but the kernel is going to only give, theoretically half to each process because it doesn't know about all those threads.
Okay. So one suggestion, or not suggestion, one observation that has been made is that because the kernel doesn't know about the presence of these threads, it doesn't know how much CPU time to give to any particular process. One process may have 10 threads, another process may have one thread or two threads. Both of them will get equal time because OS doesn't know that they're the one. Ideally, you would like the one with more threads to be given more CPU time so that all of its threads can run, make some progress. Right. That's certainly a disadvantage. Yeah, are there others? Any other comments, thoughts, limitations? No? Yeah.
There's no hardware enforced context switch, which means that if you write your code poorly, the threads could trample on data from other threads that they shouldn't. They otherwise, if it was a kernel, that wouldn't have access to, physically limited. But here it's only virtually limited by the library.
Okay, so what you're saying is you can actually have threads trample on each other. Okay, typically that is because all the threads within a process share that address space. They can trample over one another regardless. In some sense, it doesn't have to be user kernel level threads doesn't give the threads within a process any more protection than user level threads. They anyway share the same memory, they have access to the whole RAM, they can go wipe things out or trample on data structure, so that would not be an advantage or disadvantage.
I thought didn't you say there was a context switch when the kernel switches to threads?
Yes, there is a context switch, but that just says you will start running another thread. All threads still have access to the same region of memory. It just picks a different thread for running. A major limitation of user-level threads is that you can actually get limited concurrency if your threads do I/O. The reason for that is as follows. So let's suppose you have a application or a process with 10 user level threads. Okay? Let's say one of them does a print. Okay, or so it tries to write to a file. Okay? Writing to a file is I/O. Okay, remember I said when we were talking about processes, whenever a process does I/O, it goes from the runnable state to the what state? Wait state. Okay. So one of the 10 threads does I/O, okay. The entire process goes into the wait state. So even if all the other 9 threads are ready to run, the process as a whole has been blocked. Okay. So in user level threads, if any one thread does I/O, the entire process will block because the OS cannot distinguish between threads, so it will block the whole process. Okay. In kernel level threads, if one kernel level thread does I/O, okay, out of the 10 that are within a process, only that kernel level thread needs to go into the wait queue. Okay, the other threads can stay in the ready queue and actually the process as a whole can continue to make progress because other threads will get to run. Okay. So what this is saying is true concurrency is hard to achieve in user level threads packages if the threads do any I/O. If the threads are only doing computation, then it's okay. Then the user level threads library can switch between threads and all the threads will make progress. Okay? But if any thread does I/O, all threads block. In kernel level threads, if any thread does I/O, only that thread blocks. Okay? So you get better concurrency in kernel level threads in the presence of I/O. It's a very important distinction. Okay? It's not apparent when you think about it, but then once you sort of understand how the scheduler works, then it's clear. Is this clear what I just said? Any questions on this? Why that better concurrency? Okay. So now it should be clear that the disadvantages of user level threads become advantages of kernel level threads and vice versa. So I'm not going to go into what are the benefits of kernel level threads. Okay, all of the things that we said here, okay, the kernel doesn't know about the presence of user level threads. That's an advantage there. The kernel does know about the presence of kernel level threads. Can better concurrency, I mean this can have worse concurrency because something blocks or some thread blocks the whole process. That's an advantage there. Okay, and vice versa. We said user level threads are more lightweight, kernel level threads are more heavyweight. User level threads are more flexibility in scheduling. In kernel level threads, you are bound to whatever the CPU scheduler in the kernel is. You can't change that. Okay, so you will see that there are slides that say what are the advantages of kernel level threads and disadvantage. Whatever is a disadvantage here becomes an advantage for the kernel level threads, and same for the advantage that becomes disadvantage. Yes.
I was just kind of thinking, wouldn't user level threads be more portable to like different systems?
Wouldn't user level threads be more portable to different systems? Okay, so actually user and kernel level threads is how you implement a threads package. Portability actually has to do with the API that the threads package actually exports to the application. Okay? So let's think of Java threads. Okay? Java threads is basically an API. Okay, you probably in the discussion section yesterday you saw some snippets on how to create Java threads. Okay? That API doesn't actually tell you whether your Java thread should be implemented as a user level threads package in the JVM or kernel level threads package. In fact, you can get a JVM that implements Java threads as user level threads, and you can actually get JVM that implement the same Java threads as kernel level threads. Okay? The portability of Java threads comes because it's basically the API. Once you write it to that API, it will work on any platform that supports Java. It's independent of whether JVM uses user or kernel level threads. Okay? So portability is an API issue. User and kernel level threads is an implementation issue. It doesn't impact the APIs. Can use the same API and implement threads packages using either of these mechanisms. Other questions on this? Okay, so I'm going to quickly go out through some other quick concepts. So this is just showing you how Solaris, which is the Sun's operating system, does scheduling. It uses a very flexible mechanism. It essentially, think of it as it supports both user level and kernel level threads, and it flexibly allows you to map user level to kernel level threads. So what it does is, in kernel level threads in Solaris are called lightweight processes. Okay? So at the kernel level, you have this notion of a lightweight process. Each process can have multiple lightweight processes, like saying each process can have multiple kernel level threads. Okay? In addition, there is a threads library within each application, each multi-threaded application, that allows you to create those user level threads that you see at the very top. Okay? And then the threads library can map user level threads to lightweight processes in arbitrary ways. Okay? So here are some examples of how you can map them. Okay? So here you have one kernel thread or one lightweight process, and there are four user level threads that are mapped onto this one lightweight process. This is a many-to-one mapping. Okay, multiple user-level threads mapped onto one kernel-level thread. This is a one-to-one mapping. For every user-level thread, that is mapped onto a kernel entity, okay, a lightweight process. This is a many-to-many mapping. Okay, and this is a hybrid mapping that uses both. Okay. Now, traditional user-level threads basically fall into this category. All user-level threads packages have multiple user level threads that all map onto one process that the kernel sees. Okay. What we have been calling kernel level threads is essentially this model. It's a one-to-one model. User level threads, many-to-one model. Kernel level threads is a one-to-one model. For every thread you create in your application, the kernel knows about some entity that it needs to schedule for that thread. Okay, so it's basically one-to-one mapping. If this thing is chosen to run, that thread runs. Okay, that's what kernel level threads are. Okay. User level thread basically is if this thing is chosen to run, then something here has to decide which of those things actually get to run on the CPU. That's your user level threads package. Okay. Solaris actually allows you to choose which model you want to use for your application. Okay, typically if you have a user level threads package, you're stuck here. Your kernel level package, you're stuck here. Solaris doesn't actually enforce this restriction a priori. It allows you to decide how your user level threads map onto kernel level threads. You could even do this in Solaris. Could do any of those things. Okay, so when you create a thread, you say, should you create a new lightweight process? Should you take this thread you just created and map it onto that process? Should you map it onto an existing process to get a many-to-one mapping? So it gives you all of this additional flexibility. Okay, so it's a more flexible model. Most operating systems don't do that. Okay, they either do that or that, but Solaris is an exception. Yes, question.
I'm a little bit confused about what the meaning of a user thread is if we're allowed to do a many-to-many, because it seems like the kernel would need to be aware of the user thread, right? So how come that's still a user thread? You would need to make some system call to make the kernel aware, right?
Yes. So in this kind of model, what happens is there are things that are done at the user level that are called user level thread. There are things that are done at kernel level which are called technically lightweight processes. In this slide, we'll just call them kernel level thread to avoid adding one more term. Okay? So think of it as follows. Each process has some number of kernel level threads. Okay? So, and it has some number of user level threads. And assume that the mapping of these user level threads to kernel level threads can be arbitrary. In this particular case, what is going to happen is as follows. You have this kernel level thread, the CPU scheduler or the OS will pick one of these three to run at some point. Okay? Let's say it picks that one. Okay? And then what the threads package does at the user level, you have a two-level scheduler here, is saying what are the user level threads that are mapped onto this one. Okay? And then it can pick from any of those that are mapped here. Okay? So what this says is when any of these three run, any of those four can be chosen to run. That's all it says. Okay? In this case, this says whenever this is chosen to run, there's nothing to decide. There's only one thing mapped onto it, so you'll just run that. Okay? Here also, there's a two-level scheduling decision. Okay? Whenever multiple things are mapped onto a kernel-level thread, you have to make a two-level decision. Something picks the kernel-level thread, something at the user-level picks one of the user-level threads that are mapped onto it. Okay? The additional level of detail that you don't necessarily need to know, but these are various threading models. Okay? Only thing that you need to know is user level threads package. It's many to one mapping. Okay? Kernel level threads package is essentially falls onto one to one in terms of a threading model. Okay, but just realize there are more complex ones which in this course we will not really look at in more detail. Okay, so that's your threading model. The last thing to mention is threads libraries. Okay, these are things that you actually program with. Okay? You already started getting introduced to the Java threads library. Okay, yesterday's discussion section, you saw some snippets of how to write threaded programs in Java. Okay, but that's not the only one. There are several others. Okay, the three that I will mention here are POSIX threads, okay, also known as P threads, Windows threads, and Java threads. Okay, so if you write your threading application in C or C++ on a Linux or Unix flavored machine, typically you will end up using POSIX threads. Okay, that's the threads package that's commonly available on those platforms. Okay, if you write a threading program in Windows, most likely you are going to use Win32 threads. Windows also has POSIX threads library, but the native threads package that's supported on Windows are Win32 threads. Okay, that's the Windows API to do threads. Okay, and then if you write it in Java, then you don't use either of those two, you use Java threads. Okay, so those are the three commonly used thread packages. Okay, the Java threads one are the most portable, because once you write it in Java, it runs on any platform that runs Java. It doesn't matter whether it's Windows or Unix or Mac, okay, same thing runs. Okay, if you write it in Win32 threads, you're going to be restricted to the Windows platform. POSIX is a little more portable. Okay, POSIX is also supported in a variety of different platforms. Okay, so here are just some examples how you can create threads and so on. Okay, in POSIX threads, basically you have a function called pthread_create. Okay, so you basically call pthread_create and you essentially pass in a function name of a method or a function. Okay, what this does is it will create a new thread, okay, and that thread will start executing that function that you have specified. Okay, that's how most thread creation API will work. You'll call a thread create call method, and you specify a function. If a new thread gets created, you start executing the code in that function. Okay, so this is basically an equivalent create thread in Windows. Okay, you'll see it has something called create thread. You give it the name of a function. It does essentially the same thing as the first one. Okay, and this does the same thing in Java. Okay, you basically create a new thread object. Okay, you specify a name of a class with a function. Okay, and then you call start. Okay, that start executing that thread. Okay, this you probably saw yesterday. Okay, any questions on this? Okay, there will be more discussion on Java threads next week. Okay, to give you more background on Java threads. Soon we are going to start with a lab that will actually make you use all of these concepts. Okay, so what I'm going to do now is switch gears and talk about CPU scheduling. Okay, so we are done with threads. The threads chapter in the book is actually done. Okay, so that's yet another chapter. So do go back and read it. This concept of threads is typically new for somebody who has not used threads before. Okay, if you don't understand any aspect of threads, come and talk to me. Okay, when you start writing programs, you'll see lots of things you hadn't anticipated. Okay, how threads work, in what order they run, and so on. Okay, so we'll come back to some of those issues when we do synchronization. Okay, but for the rest of today's class, I'm going to do CPU scheduling. Okay, CPU scheduling is basically the policy that is implemented in the kernel that picks which thread or which process gets to run next on the CPU. Okay, this is our standard state transition diagram for processes. Okay, so you, as I said, for each of these states there is a queue. Okay, in particular, there is a ready queue which includes all the threads or all the processes that are ready to run. Okay, the goal of your CPU scheduler is to pick one of these tasks, okay, one of these threads or one of these processes, so that it will start running next. Okay, on what basis you pick this gives you a variety of different policies, a variety of different properties. Okay, we are going to look at several today. Okay, we'll start with the simplest one and keep going from there. Okay, so before I do that, I want to mention that there are two types of schedulers, something called long-term scheduling and something called short-term scheduling. Okay, long-term scheduler is basically is something that the OS uses to decide how many processes to even let into the system. Okay, typically long-term schedulers have some limits. Once those limits are reached, you cannot start new processes. Okay, typically this limit is very high. Okay, you probably have not encountered this limit. Okay, a quick way to reach this limit, okay, a trivial way, is you basically write a small program with an infinite loop, and in that loop just put a fork. Okay, so this process will start creating a large number of children processes. Soon you will hit the limit on the maximum number of processes the system is willing to accept, and then you will basically start getting fork failed. Okay, cannot create any more process. You'll start getting this error. Okay, and that's basically a long-term scheduler in action. It says too many processes, can't deal with it, don't have enough RAM, don't have enough CPU. So keep in mind that there is something in the system that keeps track of how many processes to even let in. Okay, how many processes should you let the users to create. We are not going to talk about long-term scheduling in this class. Okay, I just want to mention that this thing exists. You can try it out, okay, by just forking large number of processes and see that you reach that limit. But that's all we will say. Okay, what we will actually talk about is what is called short-term scheduling. Short-term scheduling is this problem. Okay, of the processes that are already running, okay, and are basically in the ready queue, which one gets to run next on the CPU? Okay, on what basis do you make this decision? Okay, that's referred to as short-term scheduling. Okay, now there are two types of short-term schedulers that we will look at shortly. Okay, one class is referred to as non-preemptive scheduling. The other one is referred to as a preemptive scheduler or a preemptive system. Okay, what's the difference between the two? Okay, so basically it depends on what the scheduler is allowed to do. Okay, typically when a kernel schedules a process for execution, okay, the process will basically continue to run until it does IO, okay, at which point it will basically stop running and gets moved to the wait queue. Okay, or if there is an interrupt. Okay, if there's an interrupt, again you suspend execution of that process jump to the interrupt service routine. Okay? Or if the process terminates, yeah, the process terminates, then there's nothing to run as far as that process is concerned. Okay? So typically, if you, once you pick a process for execution, it will run until one of those things have happened. In this case, you basically have what is called a non-preemptive system. You let the process run until it gives up the CPU by either doing I/O, or if there is an interrupt, or if the process terminates. Okay? On the other hand, if you have this notion of time slot that I had talked about last time, it says once you start running, you can run for only a certain amount of time, and then you have to voluntarily relinquish the CPU and let something else run. That is referred to as a preemptive system. In this case, the scheduler tells the process and you run for enough time for something else to run, okay, even though this process is willing to run for some more time. Okay? So the distinction between non-preemptive and preemptive system is one where in the preemptive system, the scheduler can interrupt a process and tell it time is up, okay, time to run something else. The scheduler does not do that if it lets the job to run to completion, until it does I/O, you have a non-preemptive system. We'll look at examples and it will become clear what policies are non-preemptive and what are preemptive. Okay? So as we go in the next slide, I'll start mentioning policies. But as we go through these policies, here are some things to keep in mind. Okay, what are you trying to do with your CPU scheduling policy? What aspect of the system do you want to optimize? Okay? There are many different metrics. You might want to optimize the utilization of your processor. Pick a policy that maximizes utilization. You might want to maximize any of these things: throughput, turnaround time, waiting time, response time, and so on. So these are different criteria, okay, that you can use and optimize using different policies. Okay, so I don't know if you know all these terms that are defined here. Okay, utilization is the percentage of time the CPU is busy. Okay? A policy that maximizes it basically makes maximum use of the CPU. Okay, you are making good use of the processor. Throughput is the number of processes that finish per unit time. Okay, throughput of the system says you have 10 jobs finishing every hour, your throughput is 10 jobs an hour. If your throughput increases to 20 jobs or 20 tasks an hour, you are finishing 20 tasks every hour. Okay, higher throughput means better performance overall for your application. Okay, turnaround time is the time from the start of a process to the end of a process. That's the time for which the process ran. Okay? Typically, you want to minimize turnaround time, okay, so that the job finishes as fast as possible. Okay? Waiting time is basically the time spent in the wait queue. Okay? We will actually see policies that can minimize the waiting time. Okay? There's a time that you wait in the ready queue, not in the waiting queue. The time that you sit in the ready queue waiting for your time slot. Okay, and the response time is basically the time it takes for a process to respond to an I/O request. Okay, so if you prompt something on the screen and you type, let's say, a character, it's time for which the system takes to respond. Okay? Typically for interactive application, you want good response time. Okay? You don't want to press a key and then 10 seconds later that character shows up on your screen. That's called bad response time. You want the system to look as if it is responding instantaneously to your mouse clicks or your keystrokes and whatnot. Okay? So these are different criteria. The one thing that you will know, you will realize quickly, is that although you want ideally to optimize all of these things, okay, these all look like good goals to shoot for. You want to minimize your response time, you want to minimize wait time, you want good turnaround time, you want to maximize throughput, maximize utilization. Okay? So it looks like you should try to optimize all of these things. It turns out that depending on which policy you pick, okay, you will make some of these things better and some of these things worse. Okay? There's no one policy that's going to optimize everything for you. Okay? So you have to decide what is it that your OS kernel is going to be used for. If it is going to be used for lots of interactive tasks, let's say it's a desktop operating system, you want to basically pick a policy that will optimize that, because there are going to be users using the system. They don't want the system to feel like it's slow. Okay? If it's a server, if it's a server operating system that's running lots of jobs, you probably want to maximize throughput. You want to maximize the rate at which jobs finish in the system. Okay, that makes good use of your server. Okay? Things like, so if it's a web server, you want to maximize the number of requests that are finishing. okay, or being serviced by your web server. That's optimizing throughput. A different policy may be suitable for doing that versus this, okay, as we'll just see. Okay, so the important thing is you can't have a scheduler or scheduling policy that optimizes all of this. Okay, so now we'll start looking at several policies. These are some assumptions we are going to make. Okay, that there's one process per user. We'll only assume single-threaded processes. We are not going to complicate things by saying you have multi-threaded applications. Okay, only single-threaded processes, and we'll assume processes are independent. Okay, they are not cooperating right now. If you are cooperating processes, you have different types of schedulers that work well. Okay, so with those assumptions, let's start with the first. So here are the policies we are going to actually look at. Okay, we'll start with the simplest one, which is first come, first serve, FCFS. We'll do round robin, shortest job first, multi-level feedback queue, MLFQ. This is the one that's used in most Unix operating systems. Okay, and then we'll look at one more interesting one called lottery scheduling. Okay, so you don't have to know what these are, you will look at each of them. Okay, we'll start with FCFS, very simple policy. Okay, processes arrive into the system and they get to run on the CPU in the order in which they arrive. Okay, nothing to decide, we just have a queue. When a process arrives, it joins the end of the queue. You take the process at the head of the queue and you run it to completion. Okay, once that process finishes, you run the next process and so on and so forth. Okay, so what you have to first ask is this policy preemptive or non-preemptive? Okay, here's the definition that I put up just a few slides ago. It says a preemptive scheduler can interrupt a running process. A non-preemptive scheduler lets a process run to completion, or it allows it to run until there is IO. Okay? And I said FCFS policy basically schedules job to completion in arrival order. So is that a preemptive policy or a non-preemptive one? It's non-preemptive because by definition, just let the job run until it finishes, nothing else gets to run. If it takes 10 hours to run, so be it. All other jobs have to wait. If it takes 10 seconds, that's fine too. Okay, so you just execute jobs in the order in which they've arrived. Okay, and you don't interrupt a job once it's running. Okay, you let it finish. Okay, so this is basically FCFS. Okay, here's an example or figure that shows you FCFS. Same example, different. So there are three variants. Okay, first one says there are three. We'll use the term job. Job means a process or a thread, so it's a generic term. Okay, so we'll basically three jobs, B, C, and A. They arrive in that order. Okay, since B arrives first, you run B. Okay, here the job length is 2. B runs for 2 seconds and then it finishes. Then you run C. Here the job length of C is 3. You let C run to completion and then you run A. And this just shows if A, B, and C arrived in that order, again, there's no I.O. in any of these jobs. First run A, then run B, and then run C. And then here is what happens if you actually do I.O. You run A. If it does I.O., it basically blocks. Okay, so then if you want to make good use of your CPU, you'll run B to completion. And then you'll run A again because only A and C are left. A arrived before C. Okay, so A will then get to run until completion, okay, and then C runs. Okay, so that's what would happen in a simple FCFS policy. Okay, not much here. Okay, very simple policy. Okay, the disadvantage in this policy is average waiting time is highly variable. Okay, because the time a job waits depends on at what time it arrived into the system and how many more jobs are ahead of it. Okay, if it arrives, suppose you are unfortunate enough to arrive just after a job that is going to take 1 hour, you are going to basically wait 1 hour for that job to finish and then you get to run. Okay? But if the arrival order is the other way around, if your short job arrives just before the long job, the short job runs quickly, finishes, and then the long job runs for a long period of time. Okay? So as you can see, the waiting time is variable. It depends on what else has happened just before you arrive. You can't control that. Okay? So that's the problem with this policy. Okay, so we need to switch to okay. So next policy slightly more interesting one is round robin scheduling. Round robin scheduling is basically what was used in early versions of time sharing system or multi programming system. This is by definition a preemptive policy. FCFS was non-preemptive. Here you have a preemptive policy. Round robin is what introduced the notion of a time slice. Okay? So essentially you have a queue of ready to run jobs. You pick the first one from the queue and you give it a time slice. Time slice is the time for which it can run. If it uses its entire time slice, it has to give up the CPU. Okay? And then if it gives up the CPU, it goes to the end of the queue. That's why it's round robin. We're going to cycle between all the tasks. So each one gets to run for one time slice, then you go back to the beginning and then you do it again. Okay, you continue this until all jobs are finished. Okay, so that's the definition of round robin. So you're going to allocate CPU time to all the ready tasks in round robin manner, one time slice per job. Okay, yes, question. Okay, so we'll talk about what happens at when there's I.O. Typically, when it comes back from I.O., it will go to the end, but I'll talk about that in just 1 second. Okay, so there are two things here. So policy is well defined. The question that you have to ask is how to decide the length of the time slice. When you schedule a job, what time slice should we allocate? Okay, and I talked about this some when we discussed this notion of a context switch. Okay, so here it says if the time slice is too large, the waiting time increases because each job gets to run for longer time, all the other jobs have to wait for a much longer time to get their turn. Okay? So that suggests that you should make the time slice small. That way each job quickly gets some time and then you cycle back. So everyone is making progress, you are rapidly cycling between all of your jobs. Right? Okay, so what's the problem then with small time slice? So why would you not do that? Okay, so if there's a long process and lots of small, it will stay for a it will stay for longer than the small processes. That is for sure.
Well, I mean, it lacks that first in, first out quality.
Yes.
So it can be delayed by more processes.
Yes. So it is basically this policy is trying to be fair. It's trying to give some CPU time to everyone, independent of arrival order. FCFS respected arrival order. Okay, so it is not fair because if a long job arrives, everybody else has to wait. Okay, this one says even if there is a long job, you will give it some time and then you will move on to others, give them a little bit of time and cycle back. Okay, so that's the policy. But the question is how much time to give to each of them as you round robin through them. Okay, if you give them too long a time slot, then basically others have to wait for longer time to get their turn. If you give them a short one, then everybody gets a little bit of time and then everyone makes a little bit of progress. Now, the issue with smaller time slices is that you're basically going to have lower efficiency because you have more context switches. Okay, because after every time slot, you're going to have a context switch. Okay, so switch to the next process, next job in the queue. Okay, the more context switch you have, the more wasted work, more bookkeeping you're doing. Okay, I said context switch is pure bookkeeping, it's all wasted work. Nothing useful is happening. The kernel is just saying state, restoring state of a new process. Jobs are not actually running. Okay? Useful work only happens within a time slot, not between time slots. Okay? So the more context switches you have, the less is the efficiency of your system. Okay? So in particular, if you let's assume that a context switch takes 1 second. Okay? So let's say that's a time slot. Said 1 second, so I meant 1 millisecond. So let's say time slot is 1 millisecond, context switch is 1 millisecond. So this is what your system is going to look like. So you'll run some job for 1 millisecond, and then you'll spend 1 millisecond trying to schedule the next job, do all the bookkeeping. Run another job for 1 millisecond, do another 1 millisecond of bookkeeping, and then so on. Okay? So you'll see the half the time here is being spent in bookkeeping. Okay. Only 50% of your CPU time, which is the time in these boxes, is being used for useful work. Okay. So now assume that the time slot is 10 milliseconds. So you have a 10 millisecond time slot, 1 millisecond context switch. 10 millisecond of this, 1 of that. Okay. So here, for every 10 milliseconds of useful work, you are spending 1 millisecond doing bookkeeping. So the amount of useful work, here half the time was spent doing bookkeeping. Here less than 10% of the time is being spent for bookkeeping. Okay? If this was 100 milliseconds, less than 1% of the time will be spent doing bookkeeping. Because you will do 100 milliseconds of actually running some process, then you will spend 1 millisecond doing the saving of context, restoring, doing all the bookkeeping, another 100 and so on. So the length of the time slot and then when you compare it to the length of the context switch determines the overall efficiency of the system. Okay. Shorter time slices, as was said here, allow you to be more responsive. It reduces waiting time, but it also reduces efficiency because your context switch overhead is being amortized over a smaller and smaller time slice. So the fraction of the time you're spending doing bookkeeping is going up in the system. Okay. Longer time slices reduce the wasted work, fraction of time you have been doing wasting, but then your waiting time increases. Okay? So this is a trade-off. Okay, if you pick long time slices, you do less wasted work, but then jobs are waiting for longer to get data. You pick smaller ones, they wait less, but then you waste more time doing bookkeeping. Okay? So typically you want to pick a number that's somewhere in between. Okay, you neither want to be too neither want to increase the wait time nor do you want to spend too much time doing bookkeeping. Typical rule of thumb is to pick a time slice where roughly 1% of the time is spent in context switches. Okay? So typical context switch time on processors is anywhere between 0.1 to 1 millisecond. Okay? So if you want that 1% number, the typical length of the time slice tends to be 10 to 100 milliseconds. Okay? I mentioned sometime back Linux uses 200 milliseconds. That's where that number comes from. Yeah, because I mean, if you spend around 1 millisecond doing bookkeeping, you basically then run for 200 milliseconds do useful work and so on. Okay? That's how you pick the time slice. Yeah, that's an important problem in round robin scheduling. But now let's look at the scheduler itself. Okay, example of how this would work. Okay, so this is basically a table. This is showing you how many jobs there are in the system. That's showing you the length of the jobs. Okay. So here you have 5 jobs, all of equal length, okay, all require 100 time units. Okay, to execute, we'll assume that the length of the time slice is 1 second. For this example, we'll assume context switch time is 0. We'll ignore the context switch over it. Okay, typically it's not 0, but for this example, we are going to ignore it. Okay, and then what we want to do is compare how FCFS schedules these jobs and how round robin schedules these jobs. Okay. In terms of when they each finish, okay, and then how much time they waited in the system. Okay. Let's start with FCFS. We will assume that the arrival order is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay, that's the order in which they've arrived. So, when does FCFS finish job 1? At what time? Yes. 100 seconds. 100 seconds, right? So, it is, you'll run the first job, it has a length of 100, it will run to completion. At time t equals 100, this job finishes. Okay, so completion time of job 1 is 100 seconds. Okay, what's completion time of job 2? Okay, it's 200. Okay, this job runs next, it runs for another 100 seconds or time units. By the time it has finished, you are at time t equals 200. Okay, this finishes at 300, 400 and 500. Okay? So that's FCFS. Now think about how round robin will schedule these jobs. Yes. Will they all be 100? They will not all be 100 because this is how it round robin would work. All these would be in the queue. Round robin would pick job 1 and run it for 1 second because that's the time slice. After 1 second has elapsed, this job goes to the end of the queue. It moves on to job 2. Okay, that has 99 time units to go. 99 time units of more computation to do. It's only done 1 second of its computation. Then you pick job 2, you run it for 1 second, give it 1 second time slice, and it gives up the CPU, it goes to the end. Okay? You run job 3 for a second, job 4 for a second, and 5. So after you've done one round, each job has gotten to run for 1 second. Okay? Time has advanced to 5, because you run for each job for 1 second, 5 seconds have elapsed, and each has 99 seconds of computation to do. Okay? And this process will repeat. In round 2, you'll again pick this job, run it for a second. Okay? After 1 second, you basically goes back to the end of the queue, run this, and so on. So we'll keep cycling between the jobs. Okay? Until all of them have gotten 100 time slots on the CPU. So if you just do the math, you will see at time t equals 495 seconds, this job will actually get its 100th time slot and finish. Then at time t equals 496 seconds, this one gets its 100th time slot and it finishes. At time 497, this one will finish, 498 and 500, this is finished. All right, 496 is when this starts, 96, 97, 98, 99, 500. So at time 500, you have got each of them, I mean totally they need 500 seconds of computation, so this job will finish at time 500. Okay, so that's basically what happens. I'll talk about wait time in just a second. Okay, but I want to put up this column here. Okay, so now you can see the difference between the two. In FCFS, this job actually finished way earlier than this one. This one finished, they all arrived more or less at the same time. In that order, at time t equals 0, this job finished at 100, that job finished at 500. So vast disparity. Okay, this was sort of went out of the system way earlier than this. In this case, we are fair. Everybody is exiting more or less at the same time. Okay, within 5 seconds of one another. Okay, because you are just cycling between them and being fair to everyone. Is that clear? So the average completion time is the average of these numbers. Okay, so if you take the average of 100, 200, 300, that's average is 300, that's 300. The average completion time here is 498. Okay, so you see what has happened. You made the policy fair and average completion time went up. Okay, that's what I was saying. You can't optimize everything. If you want to be fair, then you have to give something up. This had lower completion time. But average, that has more, but it's fair. Okay? Now the last column here, okay, let me go back here, is what are the wait times. Okay, there's a very simple formula to compute the wait time. Wait time is the time you spent in the system where you are not running on the CPU. Okay? So wait time is basically that's a very simple formula that allows you to compute the wait time. Here arrival time is 0. All jobs arrived at time 0. So we can ignore this for now. Okay? So wait time is basically completion time minus job length. Okay? That's the job length. This is the completion time. If you just take the difference between these two, that gives you the wait time. Okay? If you think about it, that's basically what is happening here. So if you ask this job required arrived at time 0, it departed at time 100. Okay. How much time did it spend not being on the CPU? That's your wait time. Okay. In this case, wait time is 0 because its entire lifetime it just spent on the CPU. It arrived, it started running, it departed. There was nothing to wait for. Okay. So that's essentially 100 minus 100 is also 0. Okay. This one arrived at 100, it departed at time arrived at 0, departed at 200. Okay? Of those 200 seconds of its lifetime, it spent 100 seconds doing computation. Okay? So it spent the remaining 100 doing wait. Okay? So the difference between these two numbers is that. Okay? Same is here. This arrived at 0, departed at 300. So its lifetime was 300 seconds. Okay? Of that 300 seconds, it spent 100 seconds on the CPU. So it must have waited in the ready queue for the remaining 200. And so on. Okay, so essentially this thing which is saying take the completion time, take the job length, the arrival times are non-zero, then you have to add one more term here. So the difference between these two gives this. Yeah, so same, and that is independent of the policy. It doesn't matter what policy it is. This column here for the wait time, once you completed this column, okay, just take this number and that number, the difference is that. Any questions on this? There will be a lot more exercises, so if there's questions, is the time to ask here another one. Just slightly more complex, requires you to get your head working to compute. Okay, FCFS is always easy. Same example, but now non-uniform job lengths. Okay, jobs are different lengths. Okay, FCFS is always simplest. We'll assume again they all arrive at time zero. They all have, we'll assume 1 second time slice, no context switch overhead. Okay, and FCFS is non-preemptive, so once this job arrives, it runs, finishes at time 50. Okay. And this job runs for 40 more seconds, finishes at 90. This job runs for 30 seconds, finishes at 120. This is 140, 150. Okay. That is completion time of FCFS. Now, round robin is more interesting. Okay, round robin is going to do what it did in the previous case. It will give 1 second to each intern and it keeps cycling. Okay? So after first round, everyone has basically gotten 1 second. This has 49 seconds to go. This has 39. This has 29. This has 19. And this has 9 seconds. Okay? So you will do this for 10 rounds. Okay? After 10 rounds, this job would have gotten its 10 time slots and 10 seconds of computation time. Okay? So it is going to depart after 10 rounds. So that is basically at time 50. You would have done 10 rounds. Each round takes 5 seconds. Okay? 10 rounds take 50 seconds. So after 50 seconds, this job is done. Okay? It's no longer in the system. So now you are cycling between only 4 jobs rather than 5. Okay? So each round is now going to take 4 seconds. So you will keep doing this until this job gets its 20 seconds. Okay? Then it's going to depart. Then you will round robin between these 3. Until this job finishes, then you round robin between those 2. Till this finishes, and then you just run that for 10 more time slots and you are done. Okay? So now you will have to work out math like this in exams. So that's why I am showing you this example. Okay, so here is the completion time. Okay, so this one finished at 50. Then you did, you cycled between these 4 for 10 more time slots, then this basically got is 20 seconds. 10 more time slots between 4 processes takes 40 more seconds, so that's 90. Okay, so at 90 is done. Okay, then you cycle between these 3 for 10 more seconds until this finishes. Okay, that takes another 30 seconds, so it's 120, it's 140 and 150. Okay, now if you take the average of these 2, you'll see that in this case, okay, round robin matches the completion time of FCFS. In the previous case, round robin was much worse as far as the completion time was concerned. Okay, this did much better than this. In this case, round robin matched it precisely. Okay, so it just so happens because of the job length. In this case, round robin is doing just as well. Okay. Now, the wait times are again, you take the difference between these 2. That is that number. Okay, so you basically arrived at 0, departed at 50, spent 10 of your seconds on the CPU, so you waited for the other 140 seconds. Okay, and so on and so forth. So basically these are the wait times for FCFS, that's the wait time for round robin. Again, they end up being the same in terms of average. Okay, so the important thing is you need to know what the policy is. If you are given a table like this with jobs and job lengths, and something that say this is the context switch time, you need to be able to work out how long each job stays in the system, when it leaves, how much time it spent waiting for a particular policy. Okay? So before I move on, I want to ask if I should explain any of this again. Is it clear how FCFS works and round robin works? Okay, so then you need to just work through this. We'll have some examples in homeworks and so on. Okay, but you should expect something like this on the exam as well. Okay, so we'll do one more policy today. MLFQ is a more complex one, so I'm going to defer that to next class. But I will talk about this one, which is shortest job first, called SJF, and its counterpart called SRTF, shortest remaining time first. Okay, let me start with SJF. SJF's name is shortest job first. Okay. So as the name suggests, what this policy does is it looks at the ready queue, picks the shortest job in the ready queue, schedules it for execution. Once the shortest job finishes, looks at the ready queue again, takes the next shortest job. Doesn't matter what order they are in. Look at the length of the job and you choose the job based on its length. Not FCFS chose the job based on arrival time. Okay, in the order of arrivals, SJF picks jobs based on their lengths. Okay, very simple policy. Okay, basically picks jobs in the order of their job lengths. Okay, SJF is a non-preemptive policy. Once you pick a job for execution, you will let it run until it finishes. Okay, SRTF is a preemptive policy. Okay, SRTF is basically the preemptive version of shortest job. So you basically pick the shortest job, run it, but you give it one time slice. Okay. At the end of the time slice, that job goes back to the ready queue. And you look at the ready queue and you pick the next shortest job. It might be the same job. Okay. But it doesn't matter. You just look and you pick one that is the shortest, has the shortest remaining time. Okay. And then you schedule that for execution and so on and so forth. So SJF non-preemptive, doesn't do time slicing. SRTF again uses the shortest job but runs it for one time slice, and then the job goes back to the ready queue and you pick the one that is shortest. Okay, yes, question.
In short job first, is there any other prioritization of the jobs that happen inside IO?
Besides IO, you mean?
So IO just prioritizes CPU bound jobs. Is there any other prioritization that happens?
No. There is no prioritization whatsoever in either of these two policies. You only pick jobs based on their lengths, nothing else. Okay, so whether they do IO, don't do IO, what order they are at, all of that is not material. You just say what are the lengths of the jobs in the ready queue, pick the one shortest one. That's it. Okay. Now you can show, I'm not going to prove it, but you can prove that shortest job first actually optimizes waiting time. It is the policy that results in the least waiting time, least average waiting time in the system. It minimizes waiting time. Okay, it's an optimal policy with respect to waiting time. No other policy can do better. Okay, it's as good as it gets as far as waiting time is concerned. So if that is your criteria, this is the policy. Okay, that will optimize it. Okay, so optimal in terms of wait times. Okay, but also not a practical policy at all. Okay, as shortest job first cannot be implemented in practice in any operating system, typically. Okay, so what is it that makes it not practical? Yes. Okay, so you are jumping one step ahead. That is indeed a limitation and reason not to pick it. You can have jobs that can be stuck because you can always have a job that's shorter than your job coming into the system and that gets chosen. That's called starvation. We'll come back to that in 1 minute. Okay, so that is indeed a major disadvantage. But there's an even bigger one that makes it impractical. Is there any idea on why shortest job first may be not practical? Yes?
There's no way of knowing what the shortest job is.
Okay. So the shortest job first assumes that somehow you know the length of each job in the queue. Okay? You think about how things work in your on your machine. You start up, let's say, Word, or you start up Eclipse. How is the operating system to know how long you are going to run Word? What's the length of the job? It doesn't know. Okay? There's no way for it to know. Even you don't probably know how long you'll keep it open. Okay? So if you don't know the length of the job, there is no way to pick the shortest job. Because the fundamental problem with shortest job first is that it assumes that the job lengths are known. In most cases, the job length is unknown. At least at process creation time, you have no idea. OS doesn't know, in most cases, user also doesn't know. Okay? Only in those specialized cases where you can actually predict the job length ahead of time, okay, you can implement shortest job first. But in most cases, you cannot. Okay, so the shortest job first, although it is provably optimal with respect to minimizing waiting time, which is actually a good thing to do, you cannot implement it in practice because you don't know the length of jobs. Okay? So, we'll come back to this statement about why IO bound tasks get priority. It's not that they get priority by default, but when we do MLFQ, that will be clear. Okay? So, I'm going to do one example here. This is the same example that we had done two slides back. So we'll ignore these two columns. It's the same jobs. Okay, we'll just do this one. Okay, so five jobs come into the system. They are of unequal length. Okay, now we want to schedule them using shortest job first. In this case, we have the advantage of knowing the job length because I put them on this line. Typically, OS will not know this. Okay, so which one gets to run first? Five. Okay, you pick the shortest job of these. This is the shortest job. Okay, runs for 10 seconds. Because it's non-preemptive, this is done. Okay? So completion time is 10. Okay? Then you run the scheduler again, fix the next shortest job, which is this one. Okay? Runs for 20 seconds and it's done. So this basically here completion time is 30. Okay? This finished at 10, this finishes at 30. Okay? So you basically schedule them in that order because the job lengths are increasing this way. Okay? So this gets to run next, finishes at 60. That finishes at 100, but finishes at 150. Okay, so that's basically what is shown here. Okay, so this is the order in which they finish. Okay, the average completion time is 70. Okay, this is how you compute your wait time, completion minus job length. So you'll always take the difference of these two. Okay, so 50 minus 10. Why does that say 0? That is 0. I guess it basically, 10 minus 10, not 50 minus. 10 minus 10 is 0. That's 30 minus 20 is 10 and so on. So if you take the mean here, that is 40. Okay, you'll see that this has lower wait time than these other two policies because I said it gives you minimal wait time. You can show that there is no other policy that can give you an average wait time of less than 40 because this is optimal for this policy. So typically this policy will give you minimum wait times, okay? Lower than other policies. Okay, is that clear? So just for sake of exercise, think about how these jobs would have finished if you did SRTF. Okay, I'm not going to go through the whole example, but you need to be able to figure out how SRTF would work. Okay, SRTF is a preemptive policy that will pick the shortest job but schedule it for one time slot. Okay, that job goes back to the ready queue. You pick the job with the shortest remaining time first, schedule it and so on. Okay, so what would happen for these jobs? Which one runs first? Okay, 5 would run first. You give it one time slot, which is 1 second. Correct? So then, at the end of 1 second, it goes back to the ready queue. What happens next?
Will it pick the same one because it's the shortest?
Okay. So you pick the one with the shortest remaining time. This one has remaining time of 9. It ran for 1 second. The remaining time of 9. These ones still have these remain. They haven't run yet. Okay. So you pick the shortest job again. That is the same job. Okay. So it will run for 1 more second. You go back to the ready queue, there's 8 seconds remaining. Okay, so 8 seconds still less than 20, 30, 40, it gets to run next. Okay, so in this case, if there are no additional job arrivals or departures, shortest remaining time first doesn't do anything different. Okay, because it keeps running the same job, because the shortest job keeps getting shorter and other jobs haven't run. Right? Only if there is an arrival in between, will SRTF behave differently from shortest jumpers? Because shortest jumpers is not preemptive. Okay? So in this case, after one time slot, since this has 9 seconds left, if a new job came, let's say it needed 5 seconds, that job gets picked. Okay? Because that is shorter than the one with 9. Okay? If there are no arrivals or departure, SRTF and SJF don't work any differently. Okay? That's something to keep in mind. Okay? So we will stop here. Next time we will do the two remaining policy and then continue on synchronization.